Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host, as always. And today we are joined by Alon Barnia, the innovative Synod engineer and VP of Development and Strategic Alliances at Afeka, Tel Aviv Academic College of Engineering. With over 18 years in tech, Alon expertly blends managerial skills, technical know-how, and a passion for people to drive growth in organizations. A charter member and former president of Rotary Afeka Avivtech, he's also dedicated to community service. Alon holds a master's in industrial engineering and management from Tel Aviv University at Afeka College. He spearheads new innovative initiatives through research and industry collaborations. I've asked Alon to join us here today to share his story plus approach to interdisciplinary innovation and strategic partnerships in the dynamic world of engineering and technology. Alon, thank you so much for joining us and bearing with me through that. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And thank you for having me.
It's an honor and pleasure to have you here. Clearly, I need to work on my Hebrew and my pronunciation, but yeah, thank you so much for joining. I love you've got such a wealth of experience and knowledge. I'm so grateful you agreed to let me come on here and let me pick your brain. But before we even get started, how did you even get into the world of business and innovation and collaborating with people? Is this an example that your parents had set? Do you come from an entrepreneurial family, an innovation kind of family?
I don't think I got it in the genes, in the sense, though now that you're asking me that, interesting question, because my parents are an interesting mix. My father was an engineer, actually, and my mother was a very people's person, always a smiley, always looking for the bright side of things, always with a lot of friends around, the friends of the family. A people's person. And I think I grew up to the best of breeds in a sense, combining these two elements, the engineering thinking on one hand, and being a people's person. And all over my career, I blended these two elements together. So maybe you are right. Maybe that's where and how I grew up too.
Right. That's I love it. And so how did that lead you into things like working with the Chamber of Commerce? You've got 30 years with the chamber. It's not, how does engineering take you into the business world and commerce? And how I've got friends that are engineers and they just work for a big company.
I've gone through all these phases, and all over my career, I always enjoyed combining skills of people together, creating something new, or combining technologies, not necessarily from what they were meant to be, and applying that to other places. And when you presented me, you mentioned Synergineer, which is kind of a word that I picked to myself at a conference I was about 20 years ago, and that was a makers conference called Kinernet in Israel. And we were asked to define ourselves in two words. And I tried to do it, and I didn't really find two words that I was happy with. So I make my own mix of two words, synergy and engineer. That made the senior engineers, which I felt, which is the best description of what I am and how I am.
And I love it. I just love even what it, I mean, I struggle pronouncing it when I read your bio, but I just love what it stands for. And I think there's real magic in that because it's about, I have a firm belief that all a company is a group of people that solve the problem of another group of people and they do it via a product or service. So that's part of where I'm really intrigued. First, I just think it's the perfect term. I used to, I when I the iPad or iPod touches came out, I was one of the first to order mine. And as a bonus, you could have something engraved on it. And I had on the back is synergy is when people, wait, success is when plans and people synergize, is what I had
Wow.
on the back. So I agree 1,000% with it. So now you've also been working in marketing and business development. So how did, again, can you speak, how did you go from engineering to business and marketing and sales? That's again, two different worlds, isn't it?
First, I was always in marketing and management in the high-tech environment and with products which are very high-tech by nature. So they have a very strong engineering core. And in order to be successful in what you do, you had to have a very in-depth understanding of the engineering, but also really sales and marketing is be understanding people, your target audience, and to be honest, also caring about them.
Yes.
It's not just bullying your way in,
Yes.
it's understanding what they need and how, in the best way, what you have addresses the need. And that's where I got the kick out of it, and I think why I was successful in it.
That's a great tip. What are some of the fundamentals you think? I think it's really important that you understand and care. I think that's really lost. I actually had an experience recently with a gentleman through Switzerland, and he I would categorize as an A-type personality that's really just out to make his own money and step on anybody, everybody he could to get there. Not everyone is like this. I've run into this type a few times in my career, but he was definitely the type. I remember on a call even with him, he told me about this little like NLP hack. If you say this earlier in the call, people are more likely to trust you so you can get money from them at the end. And I first in the when I just met this person, I was like, oh, that's you're right. Like sales is a choreographed experience. But after having seen, I have a friend, I'm from Canada, the rule of thumb was don't get into business or marry someone until you've seen them through four seasons type thing. And what I want to say is when the season changed and I saw a different side of this person, I realized that wasn't necessarily choreographing a sale. It was a characteristic of how they do business. And I think I know why he's struggling. I think that's part of why he first reached out for help is for that. So I'm waxing poetic on this point because I think it's a really important one that you're talking about where the core of what you're doing has to be to serve someone at some certain.
And that's the big difference between kind of a quick sale and a short-term one, a one-time thing, and a long relationship type of a sales environment, which is what I find myself always to be in, because that's generally speaking what you're at when you are dealing with high-tech sales and high-end products for kind of a B2B environment, not to the end user. And that's where I find myself interested in being. I don't think I would never gone to a consumer product type of sales environment. That's not me.
Relationships. Was it someone's? But one of our past guests, he's been on multiple times, Brian Kurtz. He said, not everything is a sales event, but everything is a relationship event. And I think
Absolutely.
that's
Great
important.
phrase.
Yeah, that's really important. So, can you speak to a little bit then? Obviously, if you're dealing with innovative, high-tech things, there's a lot of early bird sales that are required in that. And B2B, how do you, for people that are listening, that maybe they have a new product, new service, new innovation, how do you get those first people to just go, sure, let me pay you for an unpolished, unfinished, minimum viable product?
That's a very delicate dance that you do around. And it's true. You are always in somewhat of a risky environment. And not everybody is built to live in the same type of risky environment. And especially if you are coming as a startup with an unbaked product, you feel happy that something is working, not necessarily your customers is feeling in the same way. And that's a very delicate process that you have to go. On one hand, you might be pushing him to take a little bit more risk than he would like to, thinking in his own mind. On the other hand, you might help him by that, take the risk that he needs, in a sense, to move forward and not just to play safe. To what extent you are taking to yourself the liberty to do it in a manner that he didn't choose for, that's really the balance between being honest and being a crook.
Right.
And it's a fine and it's a fine balance.
Right.
And sometimes you out of your own belief in yourself that you say, okay, it might not be readily and perfect now. It will be in 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years. You promise something with a risk factor that it might get wrong. But that's really the art of being in a startup and making the right judgment calls. And sometimes people make mistakes. And sometimes their mistake, it creates an environment that takes them down together with the people that they believed in them. And that's and the, it's a hard decision to make. And anyone who is really making a business with a startup needs to have that in mind and kind of fence the risk around. But on the other hand, you should not give up on that because that's the way to go forward. That's the way to have an added value beyond other folks, which only play safe.
Right. Yeah, I love that you mentioned the word art because I think it is an art. I thought of something, and I don't know what you think about this, based off of, again, something another guest had said. He had asked a great question when he said that, which do you think is the bigger business, HubSpot or Dropbox? And if you're unaware, HubSpot is a CRM that does 101 things. It's a big company. And Dropbox is just a file sharing tool that you upload your files and send someone a link. And apparently Dropbox is gargantuanly bigger, this one feature tool, than the CRM that does 101 things and is where you store all your contacts and you email from and take calls through, all that sort of stuff, which I thought was very interesting, especially the price points are massively different. So when you're talking about the art, I thought, what about how being able to promise one feature that you've completed with your minimal viable product and then have a product development roadmap that you're considering? That maybe is a tangible. I guess this comes back to personal preference. I had a friend that I remember once sitting down, and one friend, he's all about sell it first, build it after. And then I had another friend who said, I hate that. I've been through that. I'm never doing that again. I want to build it first, sell it, and then update it. Update, because nothing ever gets launched perfect. Your thoughts on that?
Again, it's a combination. When you build it first, you probably lost something in understanding of the real need of the customer. Because what does it mean, sell it first? Sell it first mean you had a discussion with a customer, you understood what he needs, you not necessarily have it, okay, but you understood exactly what he needs, you promised him what he needs, and that's what you are going to do. Eventually, he will get what he needs. Otherwise, he wouldn't buy it from you because it's not that you had it, you benchmarked it, okay? You sold it before you actually had it. What does that mean? It means that he bought something that he believes that's what he needs. And let's say that he knows himself and what he thinks he needs, that's what he needs. Sometimes it's not exactly the case, but in most cases, this is it. The upside of it, the good side of it, is that this customer bought really what he needs, and that's what you sold. Now, again, if you're not stupid or a crook, and let's put these people aside, we don't want to have anything to do with stupid people
Oh,
or
of
crooks.
course. Yes.
But let's say that you are not stupid and you're not a crook, and you are smart and experienced enough to know that you can deliver. And there are glitches, like in many cases in life. So, the right combination of having something that you can base your promises on, that you're not just saying, I'll have that in X, Y month. You say that out of self-confidence because you know what you have, you know what you've done before, you know what needs to be done, and that was the basis of your promise, then it's not necessarily a bad thing.
And just being really transparent with people too, I think is dang, very transparent. I heard somewhere, I stuck with me, that the engineering formula basically breaks down to brainstorming, researching, prototyping, and then making your final build. And so I think if you can give full almost radical transparency with what stage in the process you're at and where they're getting involved, obviously there's things like Godfather pricing you get in early because you're funding this. Elon Musk, I love this example. Elon Musk made $300 million selling a car he had no factory to build and no team to make. He made a prototype, was like, it'll look something like this. I don't know, but this is what we got. And this is what it's based off of our prototype, which should be able to do this, that. Some things may change. I don't know. And if you want one, just put $1,000 down. Totally refundable. And he made $300 million. $300 million selling something. But he was very honest on the timeline. It's going to be 2 years, I think it was. I forget. He was, he had proof of concept. So I think this is really powerful and important because I think there's a lot of people that have bright futures ahead of them that sometimes make silly mistakes because we're often so worried about ourselves, our company, our bills, all that. We forget about that we're here to serve somebody else. And
right.
I think this has been an important discussion to talk
about. But I think also the example that you made about Elon Musk is interesting because also the risk that he imposed on those people that believed in him was such that it wouldn't ruin them.
Right,
It might kill their dream to have a nice, fancy, top-notch car at the time that they planned for. But $1,000 would not ruin them. It would be, I wouldn't say a nice experience, okay?
Right.
Because for some of them, it probably was, you know what? For someone who is going to buy a $30,000 car, a down payment of $1,000, it's something that it's a nice story on the weekend with your friend. It won't ruin you. And that's your obligation for your customers, your partners, your employee, to have the risk level in such a magnitude that it wouldn't get to the point that it would ruin them. It might ruin you. That's okay. It's your decision to take that risk.
Right. You're taking on the risk. It's your startup.
And it might hurt them. That's okay. They have something to win from that joint journey. You can't take the risk to ruin them.
I love that. So what do you recommend to someone who's maybe starting out or struggling? Because we're in such an era of such fast-paced innovation and developments. I remember I went to this conference earlier this year, and right next door was an AI conference. And I walked over, and I didn't have a pass. I didn't go see any speakers, but I walked down the vendor alley. And one thing that jumped out at me, Google even had a booth there. And I just hired two developers to help take what we do and build in-house AI tools to help us do it better. Like, how do we put this into our processes and build little, like you get it, little tools that help us automate things. And what I realized walking the vendor alley is it felt like all the booths there were all the same phase as I was. Like they all had a past product, but what they had on the shelf was the new thing that's in development right now, incorporating this AI. And I felt like it was almost like a resetting of the playing field to a certain extent, where, and I think it's an exciting time. I think it's one of the most exciting times to be live, because before IBM, they've been around forever. And sure, maybe they have the advantage that they already have developers, they already have servers, all this stuff. But for a brief moment, everybody had reset hit on their products and you had to incorporate this new tech. And even now they're still adapting. So what would you, I'm sorry, I'm giving long-winded answers here, but, or questions, but what would you recommend to someone that's starting out or struggling in such a fast-paced, evolving world? A lot of people, even a dry cleaner now, I think there's dry cleaners that feel like they have to have an app. If I don't have an app, no one's going to know you can't just put a shingle out on the street and hope for the best. You have to have technology in your business now. What would you recommend to someone who's starting out or struggling with this?
You know, I'll make the analogy to what was the engineer that we were looking to hire 20 years ago, and what is the engineer that we are looking to hire today? Because I think it addresses exactly that question of what you would look your way with opening a new startup or something. In the past, I think you were looking for the guy who has the right answer for engineering questions and challenges. Today, you would be looking for the guy or lady with the right questions. on the top. And I think that's the big difference. And that's also the profile of the journey that a startup would have. One of the mistakes, by the way, that a lot of us are making along our professional life span is that we get in love in a certain technology, in a certain module, a certain algorithm, something. And then we look what to do with it. Today, it's different. You're looking at something and try to have the right questions around it.
Right.
And after asking enough right questions with the right enough people, having enough help even with all the AI gizmos around it, then you start to get the right direction. And that's what my answer to your question is. If you have a young entrepreneur with something in his mind, my recommendation for him to be, before you rush in and put all the energy in the MVP, okay, make sure that you've asked all the right question and listen to the answers. Don't be jailed down in your own belief. Really be open to the answers that you get to your questions.
Yeah, I love that. I may have mentioned, and I'm going to take a second here to talk about my research. We did a bunch of research in 2020 going through 100 years of academic study into what really moves the needle for small and medium-sized businesses. And we identified 8 critical success factors. And what you're talking about now is someone making sure that they ask enough questions and the right question. That's really understanding the market, having adequate market intelligence. What really comes down, because if you make any assumptions, if you just look at it as like a data analyst perspective, if you have an incomplete data set, you make assumptions, you're setting yourself up for failure. So what you really need to do before you start is you need to identify the problem that is to be solved, why it's a problem, who else solves a problem, or who wants the problem solved, sorry. Who wants the problem solved is why, and why. Can you identify the stereotypes that people have experienced in this? How many of them are out there? What are the demographics, psychographics of that? What is the cost of not fixing it, both in terms of short-term, long-term costs, realized costs, unperceived costs? And then you have to look for competitors. They say the pioneers get the arrows, the settlers get the land, right? So you don't necessarily want to be the first. Yeah, there may be no money there. You could be, but you may just want to be at a busy food stop and be the best out of the options. And so who are the other 10 solution providers in that field? What's their sales data? Where are their locations? Who's their target market? What are their offers and price points? Are there any industry benchmarks for revenue and ad performance you can get? And then taking a look at merging technology, trends, regulations, geopolitics. And then from that data set, then start looking around, making a strategic plan about how you can innovate, how you can create an MVP, minimum viable product, what your solution is, all that sort of stuff. And so I think that's such a powerful thing that you said, because it's almost like they say, when you clarify the problem, I don't know this quote very well, but it's by clearly defining the problem, the question is half solved or something like that. It's, yeah. And that's, I think, the mastery in what you suggested there.
Absolutely. And if you think about the skills that are needed today, then critical thinking is really one of the most important skills that you would like to have in any of your employees, mainly in engineering, by the way, because they have to be able to analyze and truthfully get the new direction after these answers and not be in love in the dogma that they started the journey with. And you had a whole list of questions that you have to ask yourself and really be both creative, but with critical thinking abilities to address these questions and drive the right conclusions out of them. And that became more and more important these days than ever before.
What specific skills do you believe are important? You mentioned skills. Critical thinking is a skill we talked about. Talked about asking a lot of the right questions and enough questions. Right. What other
teamwork? Because what's the meaning? Teamwork has a lot of dimensions weaved into it. being able to communicate even with your customer to ask the question, it's a teamwork. You are part of a team. So the ability to master teamwork, I think, is a very important skill. By the way, that's a muscle that you need to train. And by the way, at Tafeka, we've gone through a whole process over the last 5 years of identifying the most important skills. They used to be called soft skills. We don't like these terms. Soft sounds like something which is not as important. So we prefer the term vital skills. Ask the question and God, actually, we didn't invent the term. That was an advice that we got with someone that we shared our thoughts. And she told us, we are using the term soft skills.
Doesn't
Do
sound
you
important.
really? Yeah, do you really? Is it that important as it sounds to me from what you are saying? We said, yes, of course. Then he said, then it's not soft to you, it's vital. I said, thank you, hallelujah. So to that point, we're using the term vital skills, and we've picked. First of all, we looked, and you also mentioned that in your question. It's very important to look around. You don't start from scratch. That would be a very big mistake. So we looked around, and we looked at what was done in the States in the Abbott organization, which is the organization which is accrediting engineering education institutes in the States. They did that with 500 companies and asked them the question, what are the most important skills that you would prefer to have in your engineers? And they had a list. And we double-checked that with the in Israeli ecosystem. It wasn't that different, not surprisingly. And out of that work, we picked four teamwork and really the effective communication, languages, and critical thinking. These were the major four that we picked. And we've gone through a whole process of mapping all the 500 engineering courses that we teach at Tafeka in the six schools of engineering that we have. And at every one of these courses, we have a matrix. Each level of these skills are taught in this course. And we make sure that through kind of the student's journey over the 4 years of engineering studies, he gets to go through the experience of these skills in the three levels of basic, mid, and high. We really mean that. And I truly believe that no one is in his right mind should hire today an employee just based on knowledge.
Oh, 100, because you can teach, it can be taught 100%. So the four vital skills were teamwork, communication, critical thinking. What's the fourth one?
It's languages, being able to master English, some level of software today,
Really?
programming is a language. Even a mechanical engineer, okay, that you would think, why should he know any programming? There is nothing today in life which doesn't involve some level of programming. Even if you want to try and use generative AI and mechanism for basic software, you need to have basic understanding in order to apply that to your needs. So any profession today, it almost doesn't matter which, needs to have basic level.
I love that because so I speak English, French, and Japanese, and I'm learning. I've learned pieces of others like Swahili, Nubian, and Spanish. I need to learn Tagalog, Filipino, because I've got kids that are half Filipino. I love that, and I never considered that as one of them because I also, in a lot of what I do, I've had to learn basic HTML. I've had to learn these other things. So I
Here
really
you go.
love that. So teamwork, communication, in terms of like interpersonal skills, critical thinking, and languages like software languages, like different verbal languages.
that's part of effective communication skill. Okay, it's a combination of a lot of elements into it. But after being so many years in the high tech and also being responsible for R&D teams, I think everyone in that profile gone more than once in his life into the process that you have an R&D meeting, and there were two approaches to solve a problem. And you had two engineers coming and presenting their solution or their recommendation to a problem. After a while, you figured out that you might have taken the wrong decision because there was one who could present his idea better than the other. So effective communication skills is a vital skill for an engineer
I
and
love
for
that.
everybody, actually.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Our family, our parents, our partners, our bosses, our customers, the people that we want to do things with, the agents that travel the places. Communication is super, super important. What about habits? What habits do you feel have been most important for you over the years? And even again, you talk about working with all these different teams. What are, the critical few habits that are mission critical?
Habits which are mission critical to me or in general?
To succeeding lo over the long term.
I think is the most important habit is to be comfortable enough getting out of your comfort zone, but on a personal level and also on a professional level. If I would need to choose one thing that would make the difference between being a successful and just being okay, I think that's the one. And if you look at the colleagues, friend, acquaintance, and try really to make a profile, which of them was most successful from other and made more of a difference and a stamp in the world than other, it's this, the willingness to go out of your comfort zone. Learn new things, ask new questions, experience new things. And I feel that I've been following that track myself also in my personal life. Even 2 years ago, going to the Israeli Midbourne, which kind of the Israeli Burning Man.
Do you guys have one?
Oh yeah, big one.
Okay.
With kind of the same profile, you build a city for a week out of nothing and you leave nothing behind. And it's all about inclusion, creativeness for a whole week. And it's beautiful. And it's for me, and I'm 63 years old, that was a stretch in a sense. And it was fun. And we've built a camp with a very interesting combination of high-tech, high-level executives and crazy young creative people. And in a miraculous way, we were gathered together in a camp of 55 people, and wonders were happening.
That sounds fantastic, though.
So that's really an example. You go out of your comfort zone and great things happen.
And you
And
collaborate with
sometimes,
others and collaborate with others. I think that's
and sometimes not that great thing happens. That's
right.
also part of going out of, but then you have to be resilient enough. And maybe resilience is another thing to put high on the flag of kind of putting apart those who are successful and those who aren't. It's a tough journey, especially for startups.
I don't know if I'm old school in that. I just think it's my podcast, so I'm going to say it. I think our world has too many pacifier sucking pussies this day and age, where I grew up where sticks and stones could break my bones, but words cannot hurt me. And we're all going to die. I don't know if anybody listening to this realizes, but you're going to die. So if you went through something, but you didn't die, it wasn't bad. It could have been worse. Could have been worse. So I get what you're saying, and I agree with you on that. But I also think to a certain extent, everyone has different beliefs about what happens on the other side. Nobody necessarily knows for sure, but we're going to be dead for a lot longer than we've been living. That's pretty much guaranteed. Put your big boy pants on, wear your ovaries on the outside, and go after it. Have some what chutzpah? Is that what it is? Have some live your life. What is this? Like, yeah. So, anyways, I just when you're talking about that, I don't think there's much of a risk. I think there's a bigger risk in doing nothing and amounting to nothing and hating your life and where you are and regret, dying with regrets. I think that's such a poor. Actually, I'm going to pull this up. I actually keep this like within a few clicks of me at all times. It's something top regrets of the dying. And I got this, the man who raised me cut this out of a newspaper. It's really short. And it was just this nurse who had worked in palliative care for 35 years. She put together a list of, there we go. She put together a list of top regrets of the dying. And there's five big regrets. I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends, and I wish I had let myself be happier. Those are the five biggest regrets. And I don't
Beautiful.
know. Yeah, I think that's so. To back to your point, I think people have to be better planners, potentially, hope for the best, plan for the worst, have a big goal, and get out there and go for it. Sorry, I went on a tangent there because I felt like you're trying to create a safe space for people. I know it's scary in a startup, and I know, suck it up, princess. No, if you don't can't hack it, go get a job and deal with that struggle. If you're gonna get into this world, you got it. Like what, roof and ramen. As long as you got roof over your head and ramen, you're okay. It's scarier with kids. I'll give you that because now you're accountable to other people, right?
But you're also accountable for their ability to take risks, by the way.
Which is,
It's not just, it's of course keeping them safe,
yes.
but also teaching them how to take risks in a rightfully manner.
Yeah, this is really important. All the world populations are in decline right now. For the most important part, none of us are replacing ourselves in the developed world for sure. A lot of the developing world is also getting there, if not, they're not there already. So it's almost this other thing too, where it's like making kids wait till their 20s and 30s, late 20s and 30s to have kids. I don't know if that's working out. It's almost like we have to, having kids at 13 to 16 is not going to work. 18, I don't know. I got a daughter. I'm like, I don't know about that. Like 18, my daughter's 5 at the time of this recording, but it's what you're talking about. We got to, I don't know if there's the right answer. We're not going to solve it on this call, but sorry, you just triggered all sorts of thoughts in my head. I've been on a bit of a rant. So, but I agree wholeheartedly though, that's all.
If I may, I think myself coming from Israel, we are lucky in a sense that we have an interesting combination of kind of a high level of resilience, and that pe
As a
people
culture.
kind of, you have to be in this tough neighborhood.
Yeah. And just historically, you guys have, gone through a couple of things. I don't know what to say.
Yep. And when you think about a startup, going to a journey, there are some elements that you have to have. Teamwork, because you never go alone. You have to be resilient because you fail a lot and you have to pick up and push on moving. You have to be creative because you are faced every day with a challenge that not necessarily there is a trivial solution, and you're by yourself in a sense trying to tackle it. And I think that's one of the elements that helped us to become the startup nation in a sense. And everybody who is going through that journey needs to understand that he will need these ingredients.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Now, what do you feel are some of the future trends on the horizon that you're keeping an eye on, that maybe the audience as well should potentially keep an eye on? What do you see? in your crystal ball?
I think if you look at the list of the 17 SDGs,
Right. So, yeah.
the really
Sustainability development
the
goals.
sustainability goals that the UN kind of in a sense, this gives you the way ahead. These are the challenges of the world, the society that us as servants of the high-tech environment will need to address, along, of course, all the class the other classic things. So I think what would happen is that on one hand, in the very developed world, there will be a lot of free time that will need to fill in with games, with the gizmos, with whatever. So that will, of course, always be there. We'll need to address health, home care, and longevity of life in general, which will, of course, need a lot of solutions around medical, health, home care, etc. On the other spectrum, food security and food tech and agri tech are now the new players. And alternative proteins will kick into that as well with scalable
Are you
manufacturing.
going to eat the bugs? Is that what you're saying? Right.
Even that would not be enough. So you'll need to have factories for alternative protein, not necessarily just growing bugs, which is might be an intermediate solution, but probably not even that, not necessarily scalable enough. So I don't know. But these would be the trajectories that will present needs and opportunities.
How do you feel about? I'm trying to think of the nice way to word this. I agree with you on 100% that as a species, as a society, there are things we have to improve. We cannot deny the ocean is full of plastic. We cannot deny that we're cutting down massive swaths of forest. But there are some solutions. They say with an acre of hemp, you can produce enough fiber to replace 10 to 20 acres of trees. How do you feel, or what are your thoughts on tackling these 17 issues? I don't know if there's a proper answer to this. I'm struggling for a way to tactfully say it, but in a real meritocracy towards good solutions for these 17 things versus Trojan horse agendas and nepotism because it's always been this way, or it's always been you. I think you get what I'm getting to. Like, there's real issues we have to address. But there are also powerful people with agendas. Certain people don't want things to change. What are your thoughts on that? Have you seen? Yeah, I'll shut up.
And as you mentioned in my bio, I'm part of the board of the Israel America Chamber of Commerce for
Right.
many years. And this is a group of high-level executives representing mainly large corporates, the biggest in the world. And if you look at the environment of what we call ESG, environmental, social, and corporate governance, up to, let's say, 5, 6 years ago, it was, to be honest, mainly greenwash. You did things because you needed to look good and
Right.
to have positive PR. Over the last few years, we've seen significant change, real significant change. And to be honest, it came both bottom up and top down.
Yep.
Bottom up means that the new younger employees of these corporates, they really look for meaning.
Yeah.
They really want to work in places that do good, and they don't want to work for places who gives a shit. Sorry for my
All
language.
right, you're good. We're all grown up here.
But so that was a bottom-up thing. On the other hand, you find more and more executives, and even Bill Gates is a great example for that, who made at a certain point in their life a personal decision of do no harm and do good. These two kind of vectors together made a significant transformation of this empty world ESG to mean something today. And that's, and I would say that most companies today, really, most companies today are really mean to do good. Not all of them found the right way. Not all of them have the same courage to make the tough decisions, to make the judgment call between the bottom line and the upper meaning. But we are on the way. We are on the right way. And there is a big shift.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you're right. We are on the right way. Yeah, that was a good answer. I don't want to give Bill Gates any credit. I used to be a major fanboy of Gates, and I know that there's a lot of talk of him online. I was someone who went from being a fan of Bill Gates, where I read his letters, I read the books he recommended, I subscribed to him on YouTube, I get his posts, to being one of the people why he shuts his comments off on everything, because there's something that really smells there. As someone who was once an avid, they say sometimes the evangelist turned, it's the opposite. If you have a really cranky customer, if you serve them well, they can become your biggest evangelist. And I was the opposite. And I saw it unfold before my eyes. I developed my own theories before I found any theories on the internet, just by following him. December 2019, publishing a video it's still on his YouTube channel, called Limits to Growth, where he interviews the author of the Club of Rome paper, Limits to Growth, talking about population growth being a major issue. And the Club of Rome website, if you go to archive.org, it has no history prior to, I think, 2018. Even though the website, if you look up when it was registered in 1996, the whole Club of Rome website's been scrubbed. There's just things like that. Announcing Gavi in January, just as the pandemic unfolded. But I love what you're talking about with it's a ground up and top down. And I think that we've gone, sorry, it's my podcast. I guess I'm using this to say, but I think there needs to be more conversations about things like this. And I think what you described is really accurate. There's people with good intentions, which we have to be careful. The road to hell has been paved a few times over with good intentions. But there's also, what I love you say, is there's enough pressure from the bottom up that it makes a difference. And I think the two is where the magic is, because we are doing this as a species, not just as individuals. And I think that's the real silver lining in the message, that we need to have discussions around this. Because that's what I asked. I think, how do we move forward? How do we move forward knowing that? And there's entrenched things. Look at cigarettes. What is the benefit of cigarettes? There's no benefit to cigarettes. There's none. And they've been pushed out of all the Western countries. And I've seen in the developing nations, they're hitting them so hard because they don't have those restrictions, and a lot of them are corrupt. And so there's these things where there's these old power structures of sorts, you know, that serve no purpose for our species as a whole, that are there because they've been profitable and they've had the relationships to maintain. But I really love what you're saying, that there's a top-down and a bottom-up approach, and that it does make a difference. And I think that's even why I do these interviews, because I think it just comes from people connecting and trying to agree on what success looks like.
Yeah. And I feel fortunate personally, being in the academic environment in the last few years, and we define ourselves not just as an academic institute, but as an academic education institute. And the word education means a lot. And part of it is really educating the young generation to feel pride that these are the things that are important to them, and actually give them the tool to utilize all they know, all they learn, all they practice. Do good.
We're really lucky. There's a lot, humans, we're fault-finding machines, but at the same time, it's hard to complain about how far we've come. I always think about this when I'm driving down the road. I always think about it. I always say a little thank you to the men and women that worked in the blazing hot sun to pave the road, and that were there for days, weeks, months, so I could get where I want to go in 20 minutes. And it's almost, this gets really deep at a certain point, where it's like, when did you can take that right now, this conversation is made possible because of literally thousands of years, millions of years of history, that's all cascaded like waves on the beach to come to this moment where you and I get to talk and speak these words. We are literally on the top of a pyramid of time and existence that has unfolded. And all this is possible because of our ancestors. I didn't figure out how to make a laptop. I didn't figure out how to make a microphone. We already are cyborgs. So there's so much, and I know that we're fault-finding creatures to a certain extent, but there is a lot to be grateful for. And I'm very grateful that you've come and shared your thoughts here. I know you have a hard stop. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
No, I think we had a great hour together. Thank you.
And if people want to get in touch, if they have any questions or what are some, where, how should they reach out?
Email is, you can find me on LinkedIn. That's easy, Alon Barnea, or email alonb@afeka.ac.il. I'll be happy to communicate.
So that's Alonbarnea on LinkedIn, or alon.b@afeka.ac.il. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yes, perfect. Alon, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming and sending love to you and your family.
Thank you. Let's have a great future together.